Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Craig Buckman, Chief of the Division of Skull-Based Surgery at UNC, about giving someone the ability to hear. This is a series we're doing on major innovations in medicine, surgery, and hearing loss for today.
Yeah, I'm really excited, Christy, about this new series because, you know, there are times in which major new advances occur and perhaps people don't know it until long after. And we think this is one of them. And we're really excited that it was done at the University of North Carolina. And we can talk with one of the originators of this important advance. We also have some important advances on research that we're wanting to bring to Your Health listeners today. One about a common condition, depression, and a common treatment, psychotherapy.
About childhood obesity and its relationship to hypertension.
About a potential advance in the treatment of Lou Gehrig's disease. We did a show about this, ALS and Lou Gehrig's disease. We're excited to talk about this.
And finally, about electronic cigarettes becoming more popular with teenagers.
Well, let's dive right in, Christy, which is looking at people who have depression, which is incredibly, probably one of the most common conditions we treat in primary care across the United States. And then what treatment is best after someone has been treated for depression? Should they have psychotherapy? Should they have medication? Should they have both or neither?
And really, we're talking about two studies that were published in the journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, psychiatry, about an important innovation and discovery about depression. And in this case, we're looking to see if what happens after someone has a depression episode. They get through it with medications or counseling, and then how can we prevent a relapse?
And what they found is that those who had this, what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and we'll have our health sciences librarians at UNC put a link to our blog website about CBT therapy, but a form of therapy that helps people manage their emotions and their thought processes, that if you have those after you've had a diagnosis of depression, it can be as effective as an antidepressant medication in preventing relapse for those at high risk of depression.
And also, the other study we're looking to see about preventing depression in at-risk teenagers, finding that this cognitive behavioral therapy did better than usual forms of care in teenagers in preventing them from having a depressive outbreak.
So we're really finding out a whole lot more. And Christy and I are really excited about this type of research because we've known that people who've had depression are at high risk of relapse. What we haven't really known is, well, what's the best way of managing it? And for some people, medication works really well and it's easy. And you know what? It is less expensive perhaps for them than undergoing mental health therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. On the other hand, some people don't want to take their medication or that medicine. And so this is not a good alternative.
And also, we know that the therapy can be as beneficial as the medication. And we've talked about that before, Adam. But now knowing that continuing with the therapy afterwards really can make a difference in prevention, to me, is important information that will help me guide patients in a meaningful way.
And we don't know if the mechanisms are the exact same. Maybe they both work through these neurotransmitters or other ways, but we'll find that out as with more research, but they're both effective. Speaking of effective, this is the next research that matters, Christy, is about what happens if we're not effective in having children who are overweight and obese lose weight.
And I don't know about you, Adam, but I see this commonly in our adolescent population and in our clinic of children who are overweight who also then develop high blood pressure, even as teenagers. And this is a study looking to follow 1,100 healthy teenagers in Indianapolis over time to see what happened to the normal weight teenagers compared with the obese and overweight teenagers as they grew into adults with their blood pressure.
Yeah, these researchers started way back in 1986, tracking these adolescents, looking at the height, the weight, and the blood pressure 2 times a year. They found about 2/3 were normal weight, while 16% were obese and 16% were overweight. And now that they followed these youth into adulthood, they found that 1/4 of the children that were obese ended up with high blood pressure, compared to only 14% of those children who were overweight and only 6% of those who had normal weight as children.
So
wow.
That's 4 times greater risk if you're an obese child of having high blood pressure when you reach adulthood compared with people who are at normal weight. And we're seeing some damage to hearts in people in their 20s because of having this high blood pressure throughout their teenage years. And I think this is another wake-up call for us to continue working on our strategies to address this in our nation.
Yeah, obesity and high blood pressure, bad combination with you're an adult, perhaps even a worse combination when you're young and have the two of them. This was actually presented at the American Heart Association's annual meeting in New Orleans. We're going to get links up there, both about childhood obesity and childhood hypertension. And we'll thank our health sciences librarians for making those links for us.
Thank you, health sciences librarians. Let's do our next research that matters. And this is some real hope on a study looking at new therapy to slow down Lou Gehrig's disease.
And this was a study that was actually done in mice models, so it's not yet ready for primetime human studies, but they really try to look at the kind of the path that the damage might occur in the type of Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And Christy and I, we had a great show with the director of Duke's ALS program on the show, but to figure out if they could identify the pathway, could they intervene and perhaps slow down some progression?
And I mean, we know this is a fatal disease. It attacks and kills nerve cells and, is progressive over one's life until the end. And so to have a breakthrough that looks like it really could slow the progress is, even though it's just in animals, I think shows some good promise.
Yeah, they were blocking genes that we have even a hard time saying in pathways, the SOD1, and inhibiting a substance called AAV9.
Very
and
complicated
short
stuff.
Hairpin RNA. These are things that we know are important. We're bringing it out there. There's research going on. Let's support the research for ALS. Let's support the research for MS. Let's do what we can to make these types of diseases that are preventable, hopefully one day, things that we can look back on and say, yes, we made a difference.
Absolutely. Speaking of making a difference, you've made a lot of difference throughout your career in the tobacco problem and helping people quit and helping with policy change that will help people quit and be healthy. But this is a study looking at electronic cigarettes, which have shown some benefit to help people quit smoking, growing in popularity among teenagers and young adults.
Well, and this is really important research, Christy, because we have been concerned with the explosion, literally, of electronic cigarettes, sometimes in people's mouths, but the explosion in terms of use, really, and the explosion really being a concern of, are they safe? Do they help people quit? What are the side effects? But then also, was this a gateway for use by youth? And I think what we are discovering is the answer is probably and possibly. And that's what this study from the Centers for Disease Control started to look at.
And so, I mean, the study showed that 1 out of 10 American high school students were using these electronic cigarettes in 2012, which is like double the rate of e-cigarette use the year before. So it's really a sharp increase in the number of young people who are using these. They do have some nicotine in them, yes, and some addictive properties to them that may be something children are doing to be cool that then guides them into smoking. What do you think?
Well, and a lot of the youth use more than one form of nicotine. And so mm-hmm. this is potentially a new avenue. We do know some states are making it illegal for youth to buy electronic cigarettes. North Carolina, several other states have passed such legislation. That's an important step in the right direction. Many of us hope the Food and Drug Administration will step in and offer regulations because in the absence of them, it's like the Wild West.
That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Craig Buckman from UNC about a major innovation in medicine, surgery, and hearing loss. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, it's really exciting that we're introducing a new occasional feature on our show about major innovations, major advances in care and medicine. And our first guest for this new feature is Dr. Craig Buckman, Vice Chair of the Division of Ear, Nose, and Throat at the University of North Carolina, and one of the great innovators here about this new major advancing someone's ability to hear. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Buckman.
Thanks for having me here, Adam.
Now, Dr. Buckman, we have a lot of amazing guests on the show, you being one of them, and love to hear the story of how you became or what led you into auditory surgery.
Well, that's a great question, Christy. I think it started back in medical school for the most part in seeing ear, nose, and throat surgery as a medical student. And as I saw the tiny little hearing bones for the first time in this really intricate surgery in a really small space, it just was incredibly compelling to me. And then seeing patients afterwards and seeing the dramatic changes in their life from being able to hear better, communicate better with their family members, it just was really impactful.
Well, you know, you tell that story of medical school, and I remember my first anatomy exam, they had a little small white bone on top of this large plate, and I couldn't figure out, what the heck is this? I've never seen a little small bone outside the human body. What is this bone? And it was one of the bones of the ear, of course, which, of course, drove me not to go into ear, nose, and throat. But these are very small areas, yet our lives depend on the volume of information we take from the largest areas. Help us understand, where is ear, nose, and throat's role in advancing our understanding of hearing and the evolution of that in the last 20, 30, 40 years in society?
Well, that's a great question. I think otolaryngology as a field, especially for ear and hearing problems, we're physicians that spend our time trying to understand diseases of the ear and understanding how those impact upon the function. And then as a field, we look to use different technologies or surgical procedures and approaches to try and restore or at least make better some of those problems that are caused from the various diseases that affect the ear. So in otolaryngology, over time, there's been a greater and greater emphasis on increasing use of technologies in the form of devices or different procedures in surgery. And it's really been amazing how
aids. Right. Maybe 60 years ago, I don't know if there were hearing aids.
Sure,
that's the
sure.
They came about sure. 30 years ago, and the advances in those have been dramatic, I'm certain.
Yeah, so hearing aids have improved dramatically as microprocessors and chips and whatnot have allowed us to be able to process sounds better. And similarly for devices that we use for hearing that are implantable, like cochlear implants or now more recently these brainstem implants.
Well, I want to jump into the brainstem implants. You recently performed an auditory brainstem implant on a young 3-year-old boy who was born without these cochlear nerves. And I wonder, just in order for us to have this conversation, if you might first break it down for us, what are the cochlear nerves for our listeners, and what does it mean when we're talking about brainstem implants?
Right. That's a great question. Thanks for asking. The basics of hearing is that there's an ear canal that we all recognize on the side of our head. It's a hole there, and it carries the sounds to the tympanic membrane or the eardrum. Then those little hearing bones that Adam discussed transmit the sounds to the inner ear, which is called the cochlea. And then the cochlea takes the vibrations that come down the system and actually changes it into neural impulses, which are carried to the brain on the cochlear nerve.
So the neural impulses are like signals to the brain.
They're signals to the brain that come from the cochlea, and then the brain has to interpret those signals as sound.
And so when you tell us how you began to think about a major innovation here for hearing and hearing loss. What you know, where did it start? I'm sure you just didn't have a dream one night. I have a dream about this.
Right.
You must have had conversations with colleagues. Help us understand how you started and what did you do first, second, third. Take us the story.
Right. Well, my my training in ear-specific disorders was in Los Angeles at a place called the House Ear Clinic. And there I had the opportunity to interact with a number of real pioneers in the field, the people that invented the cochlear implant, the people that invented the auditory brainstem implant were there. And so that was the earliest days of learning about these devices. And then as time went on, really, I think we've learned more and more who may or may not be better candidates for that. And in the case of the recent brainstem implant that we did in a child, that was new work for the in the United States, but work that had already been going on in Europe, specifically in Italy. So that's really how most of it has come about, is we've just grown over time to take these devices and apply them to in a broader context or in a new indication.
So what exactly do you do in this particular procedure?
So for a brainstem implant, after we've identified a child as not having these nerves or not able to benefit from other lesser invasive technologies, we actually make an opening in the back of the head and go next to the brain, go directly down to the brainstem, and then we take this device, which is able to transmit the information, and we place these electrodes directly on the brainstem. And then we close up the skin, and you're done with your operation. And then you take an external device, which you wear, and that device codes the information for the internal device to stimulate the brainstem.
That sounds so cool, but I'm going to need you to explain it again.
Okay. Yeah, you just snap your fingers, Christy, right. And you can learn this in about 6 months, Christy.
Well, no, it's the use of technology to do something that is, it's mind-blowing that our bodies do this on their own, in most cases, and that you could create a technology to do that. So explain it to us one more time.
Okay.
You put the chip in the brain.
Right. So most simply put, it's an electrical current it's a stimulator that delivers electrical current to little electrodes. And so what we do is we place the electrodes in the part of the brain that recognizes sound. And so then an external device that interacts with that device that we placed can code the sound, can take the sound and make it into its individual parts, and then stimulate those electrodes so that you can hear.
So you're not creating new nerves here. This is not transplanting nerves that didn't exist. You're in some ways bypassing that nerve that's missing.
Right. So the cochlea is not functional in these cases, and the nerve is not functional in these cases. So what we're doing is we're taking the information to the next station in the brain that would be able to recognize sound. So we're bypassing the cochlea and the cochlear nerve.
The bridge that's at an impasse. You have a detour that is it's real time though, because for these patients who would benefit, they hear the sound in real time, correct? There's no significant delay.
That's true. That's true. They're seeing it and using the information in real time.
So who benefits? Who are the type of patients who benefit and may be candidates for this type of breakthrough?
Generally, patients that don't have a cochlea or patients that don't have a cochlear nerve. And so those might be in adults, which is who the device was originally designed for. Those would be patients that have had tumors of their auditory nerves and then lost them as a result of either these tumors or surgery or some other treatment that was required to treat them. Children that might be born without their auditory nerves, it's a small group of children, but it's a real group of kids that we see that don't have that. Or others that may have had their system working okay, but maybe were subject to some severe trauma or something and had transection of their auditory nerves from like a terrible accident or something like that.
Like an explosion?
Explosion or maybe
people who were at the Boston Marathon and they explosion and ruptured their eardrums and lost the hearing.
Yeah.
Is that not?
Yeah, probably not. So people who've lost their hearing from sound exposure, generally not. You're usually talking about someone who's been in a horrible accident and really had terrible trauma to their head.
Well, this is exciting stuff, and I am looking forward to continuing this conversation. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with Dr. Craig Buckman from UNC about a major innovation in medicine, surgery, and hearing loss. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Craig Buckman from the UNC Division of Ear, Nose, and Throat, and really one of the innovators here in the United States of what is a major innovation in healthcare, providing hearing for those who may not ever experience being able to hear. And Dr. Buckman, I was just thinking that this has got to be incredibly powerful in terms of how it feels to see someone who's not been able to hear to finally have that ability. And then from their experience, tell us a little bit about what it feels like, what you experienced, what the patient experienced.
Yeah, that's a great question, Adam. You know, communication is, especially communicating using our mouths and our ears, is what makes us uniquely human. And seeing children who can't communicate with their families in a direct way, or in a way using their ears and voices is really dramatic. It's really it certainly creates a major problem for these families. And when you're able to provide hearing for a child when there's two hearing parents, it just opens their entire world up. It allows them to simply communicate when they're eating and being a family, communicate in the bathtub, and ultimately go on to gain educational milestones and ultimately become members of society that do the same thing that we're doing right here in this room. And so being able to do that or provide the opportunity for those families is really just, it's incredibly powerful and gratifying.
And what have you learned from these young patients? I'm thinking of a couple of my older patients who've received cochlear implants. And but for a child who has never been able to hear, is it just sensory overload at first, or how do they respond?
So for adults, thinking of your practice, those patients, you know, what happens with adults over time is as they lose their hearing, they become more and more socially isolated. Mm-hmm. So they tend to back off from their usual interactions. They don't work. Then they stop going to social events. They don't go to restaurants. And ultimately, they end up sitting in a chair at home and reading a book. And so many become depressed, and it can be a big problem. For children, of course, they don't know any better. And so it's actually watching children gain communication rather than lose it over mm-hmm. time. And so for children, it's a sort of a different dynamic.
Well, we know that hearing loss in kids is really hugely prevalent and perhaps, at least my belief, still really underdiagnosed, that we're missing opportunities. What do we know about prevention and early intervention? Because that's the other end of the spectrum, and I'm sure that you and the Division of Ear, Nose, and Throat at UNC is heavily involved and invested.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for asking. So hearing loss in children is common. It's one of the most common congenital problems that we see. Affects 3 to 4 per 1,000 births in the United States, and about half of those are genetic. Newborn infant hearing screening has been mandated, or at least highly encouraged, in the vast majority of states now. So the kids that are born deaf or born hard of hearing are being identified at a pretty good rate. The bigger problem these days is making sure those children get the services that they need at an early enough time, because delayed intervention still results in big time problems in terms of delays in your ability to develop speech and language. And so we're all about early intervention.
I'm thinking of some patients of mine, siblings, who were both born with congenital hearing loss. And thanks to UNC hospitals and your division, they're receiving wonderful care with hearing aids that get adjusted as they grow. But how do you decide and determine which people are eligible for just continuing with hearing aids versus cochlear implants versus this brainstem implant you're speaking of?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, I'm glad to hear that our patients are doing well.
They're developing well, and it's very exciting.
That always makes us feel great. The vast majority of kids don't have enough hearing loss to require a cochlear implant. So most of those are well fit with hearing aids, and they do fine. If their hearing goes down over time, they may become a cochlear implant candidate, and we can determine that based on using sophisticated hearing tests. In terms of adults, really, if an adult has enough hearing loss that they can't talk on a phone, they're probably a cochlear implant candidate, and I think that's a really simple marker for that. In terms of children, when you start thinking about children and brainstem implants, really, a brainstem implant is really only indicated if the cochlea is absent or the cochlear nerves are absent, and then possibly if it's a confusing situation where a cochlear implant's not working for them. So that would be really an unusual case. The vast majority of patients do well with hearing aids. If they don't do well with hearing aids, they're a cochlear implant candidate.
You know, I know going back to my own medical training, when hearing aids first were out there and becoming available, the expense, and I know they're still quite expensive, and I know a lot of the elderly have difficulties with expense. Help us understand some of the cost of the different procedures, what's available that helps patients afford and get access, and for those who have less resources, including even healthcare reform. Help us understand this.
Yeah, that's another great question. So hearing aids, for the most part, are not covered by insurance. So
crazy.
That's
just crazy.
It is crazy.
Let's call it what it is.
It's crazy. So for the vast majority of people who need hearing aids, they have to pay out of pocket, and it's a substantial cost. Cochlear implants or any other surgeries that are directed at restoring hearing, for the most part, are covered by insurance, so they're considered medically necessary, and so we work hard to make sure that patients have access to that. There are some states where cochlear implants are not widely covered, and so that's always a challenge, especially in Medicaid population. So we work really hard to make sure that patients have access. The devices are extremely expensive. They're thousands of dollars, and so insurance companies do have to come up with a lot of money to make these happen, but it certainly is a great endeavor, and it's life-changing. And I think in the long term, it's really important to think of the medical economics of an intervention like this. If you take a one- or a two-year-old child and give them a cochlear implant, that child becomes a member of society that can do the things that we're doing right here in this room. And when they do that, then they don't require specialized schooling. They don't have to go to specialized centers. They can attain jobs like we're all doing here, and ultimately be very productive members of society. So I think in the long run, these devices actually save money to society.
Well, and you wonder from the insurance company perspective, if we had further data to link hearing with health outcomes and utilization and how much it actually costs them to care for patients, then maybe they would start paying more attention.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's an alliance that's actually working towards this called the American Cochlear Implant Alliance, and they've been working very hard to try and start generating those sorts of data.
Well, maybe we can, if you can provide us a link to that alliance, because I think you've got a couple advocates right here who haven't really thought about, well, why is this the case? Why isn't it different? I mean, if we can provide medications for sexual function, and we can provide vision services and speech services, we certainly can provide hearing services,
right?
Because many of us, if not maybe most of us, if we live long enough, will need these types of services. This is a no-brainer.
Yeah, it seems pretty straightforward to me as well.
Well, in our last minute, maybe if you have any advice for our listeners out there about what you see as kind of the future of your field and the kind of really major groundbreaking work that you're helping pioneer.
Sure. You know, hearing loss is very, very common. And I think as people are living older and older, they're more and more being affected by this process. Technology is improving every day. It doesn't seem like today that restorative or regenerative medicine is going to provide the answer in the next 10 years. So replacing hair cells and inner ears and regenerative approaches probably are not going to be the short-term fix.
Well, it is certainly so exciting to hear these breakthroughs, and we're grateful for what you're doing for our patients with hearing loss and helping to change their lives. It's remarkable.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Dr. Craig Buckman from the UNC Division of Ear, Nose, and Throat. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And Christy, for any of our listeners that would like us to address their health questions, they can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're going to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to tell us our very first House Call question today about a patient about to have surgery.
I have a minor surgery coming up, and I've been told not to eat or drink after midnight the night before. Can one cup of coffee the morning of surgery really harm me?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it's one that you might think, gosh, just a cup of coffee shouldn't be a big deal. But the concern that the surgeons and the anesthesia doctors would have is that if they're giving you sedation for the surgery, then you could potentially choke that coffee. If it's still in your stomach, you could choke or have what we call aspiration from what's in your stomach. So that's the reason they don't
If you don't mind coffee in your lungs, then I guess it's because you've already said it's a minor surgery and you've already kind of ignored the advice of the doctors to not eat or drink. So, you know, we're kind of worried here a little bit. Minor surgery is like taking a mole off and you can have your cup of coffee before that surgery. But minor surgery is not where you undergo general anesthesia in terms of the risk of eating and drinking. We do not want you having coffee in your lungs.
No, and probably if you told them that you had coffee, they won't do the surgery. So I'm not saying drink it and don't tell them. I'm saying don't drink it.
And this is not like having that cup of coffee before you go in and have your cholesterol checked. We're okay with that. If you want to get your cholesterol checked and you had a cup of coffee that morning, you're probably okay.
It won't be as accurate, but okay, but it's not as life-threatening. Okay, let's do our very next House Call question.
Why is it that every time I go to the ER, I end up sick? Aren't hospitals sterile? I heard your show on medical errors. Is this just another unavoidable problem?
Well, I do think that there are about four questions there that we're gonna try to dive into. You know, when you go to the emergency room, you probably are sick, so how you end up sick is an interesting question. There are lots of bad bugs in that emergency room. There's no doubt about that. But you are kind of sick a lot of times when you go into the emergency room.
And the question of, are hospitals sterile? Absolutely not. There are germs everywhere.
Even lurking.
They're lurking. They're waiting for you. They are looking for you. And even those, you know, germs like MRSA or the germs that are resistant to certain antibiotics are hanging out in those emergency rooms. So if you're going there because of non-emergent things, you might want to rethink about that, because you're certainly exposing yourself to more germs by being there because of lots of sick patients who are there.
Now, the good news is that hospitals do recognize this and are trying to intervene. You'll see about every 3 feet, one of these devices that you can say pump 2 times, and it has this antiseptic, this antibacterial lotion that you can put on your hands. And when you have people that come in to see you in the hospital emergency room, ask them to actually do it and watch them do it. And that way you can be assured that the people that are touching you are less likely to be transmitting things that are more hazardous. I think that's one way that you could help yourself.
And whenever you go to the doctor or the emergency room or anywhere, you should wash your hands when you leave and be just very aware that you've just touched a lot of germs. On the counter, on the bed, wherever. They're there hiding, and it's a good idea to wash your hands well as you leave.
And if you had a loved one that smokes cigarettes, and you think about what they're putting things to their mouth and touching their mouths, and they come in again to the waiting area to see you or to the room, make sure your friends and loved ones wash their hands. So maybe that message, Christy, is wash, wash, wash.
That's right. Wash, 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 and don't go to the emergency room unless you need to.
Thank you so much for your question. Erica, what's our very next House Call?
I am not one to take medications, but sometimes I take pain relievers. What do you consider to be the least harmful on the body? Tylenol, Advil, Motrin, or ibuprofen?
Are those the only choices we get?
I know.
Can we have like number E, none of the above, as in terms of the safest?
Well, the other part of this question that I like is that you list Advil, Motrin, or ibuprofen. And the thing that I think most people don't know is that they're really the same medicine. Ibuprofen and Motrin and Advil are all the same medicine. They're dosed the same. They go through your body the same. It's the same thing, just called different words.
In that medicine, Aleve, which contains naproxen sodium or naproxen, those are all the same things. And boy, this is complicated because then you get into things like aspirin and goodies powders and things like acetaminophen, which is the same thing as Tylenol. We could have a whole show just on this alone. But the question is one safer than the other? What do you think, Christy?
You know, I think as long as you're taking each one at appropriate doses, meaning not more than what's written on the bottle, then they're all pretty darn safe. Unless you had, you know, some complex medical problems with your liver, in which Tylenol potentially could be harmful, or some real problems with your kidneys where maybe you wouldn't want to take high-dose Motrin. For most people, taking these pain medicines at usual doses is very safe. I couldn't
on a
pick
periodic,
one.
On a periodic basis.
Yes.
You know, I personally like at low doses acetaminophen because I don't think you have the toxicity to the stomach, but there is a little toxicity to the liver. Most people, that's not a problem. On the other hand, the Advil and the Aleve doesn't really have toxicity for the liver, but they can upset the stomach, and they're not sometimes so great for the kidney. So it's six of one, half of another sometimes.
Take a poll of two. If you had a headache or a fever, and you were in your house, Adam, what would you take?
Well, like, I would do that option E, which would be a little bit of ice and a little bit of massage. But if it didn't work, I would probably be taking some acetaminophen. What about you, Christy?
So you would take Tylenol or acetaminophen. I would take Motrin or ibuprofen. It's just what I have. It's what I know. And I would take it with food.
I like tomatoes. You like?
Tomatoes.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Well, that you've gotten some difference of opinions here. And thank you for what is a really good question. Erica, what's our very last house call question?
My 2-year-old son had a seizure when he had a fever, and tests by his primary care doctor indicated that he was fine, but I'm still worried. Should I get a second opinion from a neurologist?
Well, Christy and I may have a different opinion about this, and my short answer is it depends. And there's a lot of information that we don't have about this situation, about other ways of understanding your child's medical diagnoses that we may not be fully aware of. Many cases, the answer is no.
I would agree with that. Febrile seizures is what this is called.
With a fever.
Yeah, seizures that where you get shaking and like real seizures related to having a fever, which is usually greater than 102. It's usually a higher fever. It's really common in children. I mean, something like one in every 25 children will have at least one febrile seizure. If there's nothing, if that's the explanation and they've had the evaluation and is one time in the setting of a fever, then probably no. You don't need to see a neurologist to do a lot of additional fancy tests because those tests won't really apply if it was just a one-time thing with a fever. I don't know. What do you think?
I think in general that's really correct. If you also, though, are worried and perhaps the primary care provider isn't reassuring you enough or doesn't know enough of the information to provide you the level of the reassurance, then a visit to a pediatric neurologist who may well actually do no test but may reassure you but may be able to give you the types of answers or explanations or the mechanisms, pathophysiology, big term for why it happened, that might be reassuring enough for you. So there might be indications for that, or at least to give you some more reassurance. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can send us questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and get our new health app on iTunes by searching Your Health for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Craig Buckman, talking about major advances in care. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we can't wait to talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.